I'd ask you to open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 13 tonight. I hope that you had the opportunity sometime through the day today to read this chapter. We'll cover it all. Probably actually read the vast majority of it as we go through our study tonight. But hopefully if you've read it, you'll be a little familiar with where we're going to go. And so we'll study from there in just a few moments. Please allow me once again to express my appreciation for the opportunity to be here. I'm grateful to the elders for the invitation. I know it's been a long time. There were some scheduling issues that took place in between the last time and this time, and so things got moved around a little bit, but I am honored to be asked to come back. I've enjoyed the weekend. I hope that our studies have been helpful. Appreciate all your hospitality, all of you that have fed me and entertained me and given me a nice place to stay. And you read in the New Testament about the apostles and the challenges that they faced going around preaching the gospel of Christ. I have no clue what it must have been like for those guys, because people in our day and age sure make it easy to travel and preach. And so I appreciate all of your kindness to me. I hope the Lord will bless you. I hope the Lord bless you in your new relationship with Brother Hunter. I was actually a student at Florida College when he was teaching there. I don't know how old he is. In my mind, he's got to be really, really old. And you can tell him that when he gets here, as far as I'm concerned. But I think that mainly because I was really young, and he was one of my teachers. Really good man and excellent communicator of the gospel. And I hope that your work prospers in that new relationship. I know y'all are looking forward to that. And I hope that all things go well for you. Any of you, if you're ever in Beaumont, Texas, several of you asked where that is. Most people don't come to Beaumont because of the beauty or the smell or lots of other things. It's not the garden spot of the state, but by all means, if you're ever there, please come and visit us at the Northwest Church. We'd be glad to have you, and hope the Lord will bless you in your efforts to continue to serve Him. We've already introduced to some degree, conceptually, what I want to talk with you about a little bit this evening. I want to try to get your mind back where we took it this morning, but I want to come at it from a little different direction. I want you to try to envision, if you can, the apostles as boys. We really don't know how old these the 12 that we know the most about or that we are the most familiar with in the Gospels. We really don't know how old most of these men were. We kind of assume that they must have been men in the general age of our Lord. They may have actually been a little younger than Him. Some of them may have been older. I don't know why we have them all about the same age as Jesus, but in my mind, that's kind of the way I think of them. They were an interesting collection. There were two sets of brothers, you had a man who was a political zealot, Simon Zelotes, or Simon the Canaanite. The Zealots were kind of the militant fundamentalist terrorists of the Jewish society. And that kind of is curious because Matthew was someone who worked for the Romans. And so I can't help but think going down the road, Matthew and Simon Zelotes must have had some interesting political conversations from time to time. And Andrew and Peter and Andrew must have had some times where they didn't get along, just kind of like brothers do. James and John, who were described by Jesus as sons of thunder, I can see them having their issues from time to time. And it was an odd collection of men. But I want you to appreciate what the world that they grew up in must have been like. If they were roughly Jesus' age, that means they would have been boys in the 10 to 15 A.D. time period, which means the Romans have been in control for, 60 or 75 years, maybe a little more than that, in and around Galilee. Most of these young men were from Galilee. And they would have been the children of fishermen. We know James and John and Peter and Andrew were fishermen. They were a part of a family fishing business, and I don't know what all the rest of them did, but I suspect that they were like other kids. They probably had their jobs, and they probably had their chores, and maybe they helped in the family business, and they probably spent some of their time running around playing, just like we did when we were kids. Only Whereas my heroes were, you know, Davy Crockett and Roy Rogers and Zorro and guys like, all my heroes had guns, by the way. Their heroes, as they're running around the Galilean hillside, they're playing David and Goliath. Don't you know the biggest kid in the village always had to be Goliath? That would have been a terrible burden to have to bear. But their stories and their background and their culture, they would have played Gideon or David or Josiah or Joshua or Moses or all these famous characters as they're out just kind of playing like boys do, reenacting these great heroes of their faith. Those are the men that they would have thought of. And those are the men they would have grown up idolizing because of all the stories of God's people winning victories, great victories. And then they would have come in the evening when their mom called them in to supper, and they would have sat around and listened to the adults complain about the political circumstances. We don't know anything about folks sitting around talking about political circumstances that we don't like, do we? You have any experience with that? Well, the Romans were running things. And don't you know, mom and dad are saying, man, I was up at the village today and this Roman soldier was just beating up on Joseph. For no reason, just beating up on him. Then he put a big burden on him, made him carry it for a whole mile. And they would have complained about the taxes, and they would have complained about this, and they would have complained about that, and the fact that they were under Roman rule and Roman oppression. And that in history, things were about to change. You know, if you read Daniel chapter 3, the great vision that Nebuchadnezzar has, I guess it's Daniel chapter 2, the great vision that Nebuchadnezzar has of the statue with the head of gold and the chest of silver and the belly of bronze and the feet of iron or the legs of iron, the feet of iron and clay and the rock coming down the hill and breaking it, growing into a great mountain. And Daniel explaining that vision that God was going to establish His kingdom in the days of the fourth empire, starting with Babylon. Well, these folks weren't stupid. They could figure out that the Roman Empire was the fourth major empire to come along since the Babylonians. And I would propose to you that there was a lot of messianic anticipation around this period in time in history. You read the first three chapters of Luke, we're introduced to some interesting people, Simeon and Anna, and people that were looking for the Messiah, that were ready, that were anticipating that this was the time. And my suspicion is that kind of mentality was widespread in Israel as the apostles grew up. So, not only were they thinking in terms, just like young men do, of these great Bible heroes, they were also anticipating, because of what they were hearing from their parents and perhaps in the synagogues, that we're coming into the messianic time in God's kingdom. It's time. God's been preparing us for this. And they would have spent time reading from the Old Testament in their worship and heard things about God enthroning the Messiah and Him ruling the nations with a rod of iron and putting His feet upon the necks of those that He was victorious over, and all nations coming to the mountain of God to worship God and the victory that was going to be God's people's. And you can just see these young men growing up becoming what's the word? Enthusiastic? Probably not right. Overwhelmed with anticipation? And then one day, this fella comes to town who teaches like nobody's taught before. He's a young man. His dad was a carpenter. James and John probably were related to him. And he can heal people of their diseases. And he can raise the dead. And the things that he says are not like the things that the scribes and the Pharisees and the lawyers taught. It was different. He sounded in some ways very much like the Old Testament prophets that they would have read about. And they saw what he could do, and they saw the impact that he had upon people. And people started following him. And some of these young men who had gotten involved with John the Baptist and that movement that John the Baptist had kind of started, they heard John the Baptist begin to testify that this was the Messiah. And you have to appreciate what they were waiting for. We mentioned this morning that I think that probably the Jews were anticipating a material, temporal, military kind of kingdom. I want you to imagine Jesus at the head of that in their minds. Here's someone that can take 5 loaves and 2 fishes and feed 5,000 people. Do you think the logistics of supplying an army would be any problem for Jesus? And he could take people who had withered hands, or people who were lame from birth, or people that were blind, or the people that couldn't hear, and he could heal them and make them whole again. Can you see that man on the battlefield engaged in warfare, and every time somebody's injured, all he's got to go over there and heal them, and they're right back in the battle? What kind of an army? Anybody killed, he could raise them. Who had the power to tell the sea to stop? To command the winds and the waves? Do you begin to appreciate, when you add all that together, why these young men would have been fascinated with Jesus? And so they spent a couple of years following him around. And they listened to the things that he had to say, some of which would have made perfect sense, some of which was puzzling to them. And they argued about things like which one of them was going to be the greatest of the kingdom, and which one was going to get to sit on the right hand, which was going to sit on the left hand. And they heard incidents like the one we referred to this morning, where the rich young ruler comes up to Jesus and Jesus sends him away and says how difficult it is for the wealthy to be a part of the kingdom of heaven. And you know that that had to make no sense to them. If you're going to run a government, you've got to have money. And why would you send away the rich people? Why would you send away the Pharisees and the scribes and the lawyers, all these people of great influence? Jesus must have been a great enigma to them. And they didn't understand the kingdom that he was promoting. They heard the Sermon on the Mount who knows how many times. In fact, they preached it who knows how many times. Yet I'm not sure that they understood it. It's a curiosity to me. If you turn over to the book of Acts, keep your bookmark in Matthew 13. But if you look at the book of Acts, even after Jesus' death and burial and resurrection, when Jesus is about to ascend to heaven, their concept is still this military empire that's going to overwhelm the world. When Jesus is ascending to heaven and he tells them, or he's about to ascend to heaven, and he tells them to go to Jerusalem and not to depart and wait for the promise of the coming, in verse 6, their response to that is, Lord, will you at that time restore the kingdom to Israel? They're still thinking, okay, let's pull out our swords. The battle's about to start. We're going to be on the ground floor of this new empire. Jesus is going to be sitting on his throne. We don't understand exactly how that's going to happen, but that's what we're waiting for. In Matthew chapter 13, you have a series of 7 parables that Jesus offers on one particular occasion. They are recorded, most of them are recorded elsewhere in different circumstances as well. But Matthew offers this all taking place at one point in time, and I think that it did. We're familiar with them. We study the parables. We use them for a variety of ways. But I'm not sure that we always use them in the context in which they were originally presented. So what I want to do with the remainder of our time tonight is I want you to appreciate what I think Jesus was trying to teach initially with these 7 parables. Yes, we're going to go through every one of them. But we're not going to be here for 2 hours, so relax. All right? Jesus is trying to get across to the apostles information about this kingdom that we talked about this morning that they didn't understand. They were the ones that are going to have to go out into all the world, preach the gospel to every creature. It was really important that they understood certain things about this kingdom that had not been understood before. And when you get to Matthew chapter 13, the chances are pretty good if you do a harmony of the gospel study and you try to put everything in its chronological sequence, the chances are pretty good that Matthew chapter 13 really takes place a couple of years into Jesus' ministry. Matthew is not necessarily in pure chronological sequence. And so for a couple of years, they've been listening to Jesus tell people things that they needed to do and how to understand the law and how to be a light in the world and how to be blessed by God and how to treat money like we talked about this morning and to seek first the kingdom of God and how to worship and all these straightforward things. But Jesus is not convinced that everybody gets it yet. So one day, as Jesus has a multitude of people around him by the sea, Jesus stands up and says, "Behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground, yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." That was it. Jesus, who's been for 2 years saying all these things about the kingdom of heaven, stands up on this occasion and tells them a story about a farmer who throws a bunch of seed around, and that's it. The apostles come to him in verse 10, and they ask him why he's speaking in parables. Actually, to be completely accurate, Jesus tells four to the multitudes. He tells the parable of the sower. There's not any record that he explains it to the multitudes. He just tells them a story about a farmer. And then if you look at verse 21, he tells them another story about a farmer. And then in verse 31, he tells them another story about a mustard seed. And in verse 33, he tells them a little bitty parable about leaven. And verse 34 says, "All these things Jesus spoke to the multitudes in parables, and without a parable he did not speak to them." So he didn't elaborate, he didn't explain anything. He stands up, he tells four stories, and don't you know that these apostles that have been following him around listening to these sermons for a couple of years are looking at each other going, "What's this about?" Now, I don't think this is the only time Jesus ever used parables. But as far as we can tell, it's the only time that he ever spoke in parables and never said anything else. So much so that if you back up in Matthew chapter 13 to verse 10, the disciples come and ask him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" This is an important part of this chapter. "Why are you doing this, Jesus?" And Jesus answers, "Because it's been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven." The word mystery in the New Testament simply means something that hasn't been revealed yet. Doesn't mean it's hard to understand. Doesn't mean that it's dark and dramatic. Doesn't mean that it's like a Sherlock Holmes that you can't figure out. It's just something that hasn't been revealed yet. He says it's been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them, that is the multitudes, it has not been given. Whoever has, to him will be more will be given, and he will have abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he does have will be taken away. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. In them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, 'Hearing you will hear and not understand. Seeing you will see and not perceive. The hearts of this people have grown dull. Their ears are hard of hearing. Their eyes they have closed. Lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn so that I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. Surely I say to you, many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. Therefore, hear the parable of the sower." What Jesus says to them is, these people don't want the truth. I've been talking to them for a couple of years. I've explained a lot of things to them. They don't see because they don't want to see. But you want to see. You want to hear. You want to know the truth. It's interesting to me. There's not any record of anybody in the multitudes calling out saying, "Hey, Lord, what does that story mean?" It's the apostles that come and say, "Would you explain these parables to us?" And Jesus says, they don't care. But you care. So I'm taking away the opportunity for them to learn anymore. They don't need it. They don't want it. But you want it and you need it because it's been given to you to know things that haven't been revealed yet about the kingdom. If they're looking for a military temporal empire, and we understand that's not what the kingdom was ever going to be, there's some things they needed to know. So, what is it that these parables teach us about the kingdom of heaven? Well, let's run through them. You're familiar with most of them. I'm not going to go into great detail in all of them. The parable of the sower. Throw some seed here, throw some seed here, throw some seed here. And what we find is the seed that falls on the wayside, it doesn't grow up at all. And Jesus explains that in verse 19. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and doesn't understand it, the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who receives seed by the wayside. We understand what that means, but I'm not sure the apostles would have. I mean, they're going to go into the nation of Israel and tell everybody that God finally has brought his Messiah into the world and God's kingdom is going to be eternally established. What Jew in his right mind didn't want that to happen? And yet what Jesus is saying is, you're going to go with this message and some people aren't going to listen to it at all. I think the apostles would have found that absolutely unbelievable. Why in the world would anybody reject the message? Well, because they didn't understand the kingdom. And you didn't understand the kingdom. And then he goes on and says, the seed that falls on the rocky ground is, he says in verse 21 or verse 20, he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, but he has no root in himself and endures only for a while. When tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. You and I read that. We understand some people are not going to stick with the gospel when the going gets hard. But if you're one of the apostles and you're thinking of the kingdom in physical terms, pray tell, who's going to persecute you? If your kingdom's the kingdom that's ruling, who's going to persecute you? Where's the tribulation going to come from? Because nobody's going to rule over you. You're part of the kingdom that's ruling. And I can't help but they're looking at this going, huh? And then he talks about the seed that falls in the thorn patch, is the way we would say it, where I grew up. He who receives seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word and it becomes unfruitful. If the typical Jew thought that as soon as the kingdom came, all the Jews are going to be prosperous and blessed by God, and it's going to be a land flowing with milk and honey again, pray tell, who's going to quit the kingdom because of their newfound wealth? You and I understand it, but I'm not sure they did. And then he finally says, but he who received the seed on good ground is he who hears the word and understands it, and it bears fruit and produces some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. What's the point of this parable? We use it to describe what's going to happen when we go out and teach the gospel. And that is exactly the point of the parable. But you know what the apostles needed to understand? They needed to understand that a lot of people you're going to go tell about the kingdom are not going to want the kingdom. You better brace yourself. There's a lot of folks for different reasons. Some people aren't going to like what happens to them physically. Some people are never going to be interested because of their devotion to Satan. Some people are going to be so caught up in living large that they're not going to want what God has to offer. It's going to be discouraging when you try to go out and teach people the gospel. On the day of Pentecost, you remember how many people roughly are described in Acts chapter 2 as having obeyed the gospel? About 3,000. You know, as a preacher, I always think, whew, that must have been a really good sermon. 3,000 people. Do you appreciate that historians estimate that at the Passover, which kind of boiled over into Pentecost 50 days later, these two feast days, the big feast days of the Jews, do you appreciate most historians estimate that in Jerusalem there are anywhere from 1 to 3 million people who came many of whom would have spent most of the day in the temple. I mean, it was jam-packed in that temple and in that city. 3,000 is a fairly small percentage of all the people that were there. We think of it as a highly successful thing, and indeed it was, but don't take it out of perception. There were many more people that rejected what Peter had to say that day than accepted what Peter had to say that day. And if I'm an apostle, I can walk off going, wait a minute. I thought everybody wanted the kingdom to come, and Jesus is trying to get them to understand that that's not what's going to happen. You better get ready. Now, if you start thinking that way, it seems to make sense the way the rest of these parables work. Verse 21 says, another he put forth to them, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. While men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. And when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? And he said to them, an enemy has done this. So the servant said, do you want us then to go gather them and burn them up? And he said, no, lest while you gather the tares, you also uproot the wheat. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather together the tares and bind them into bundles to burn them, and then gather the wheat into my barn. Jesus explains this in verse 36. The apostles come to him later and say, we don't get this one. And honestly, this is the hardest one of the bunch, and we don't get it most of the time either. Most of the time, I've heard this explained. In fact, I ran across an old sermon outline the other day that I had done 25 years ago. On the parable of the tares. And this is the way I preached it. And I was wrong. I was dead wrong. We use this parable to teach that what we need to understand is that there are going to be ungodly people among God's people. We'll usually say, you know, there's going to be tares among the wheat. There are going to be people in the church that aren't really faithful to God. But that's not what this parable's teaching. Now, I want you to listen to the explanation Jesus gives beginning in verse 37. Listen very carefully. He who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. Notice the field is not the church. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom. The tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age. The reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in this fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out His angels. They will gather out of His kingdom, which is the field, which is the world. They will gather out of His kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness and cast them into the furnace of the fire, and there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth, and the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. What is it that this parable is teaching? It's teaching that when God comes and sets up His kingdom, God's not going to get rid of all the wickedness in the world. If it's a military kingdom where God's going to completely decimate His enemies, then what would have happened is that God would have destroyed everybody that stood opposed to the kingdom of God. But what the parable's teaching is God's not going to do that. And he offers actually the reason that God's not going to do that. And I think it makes perfect sense. I don't know what all y'all grow up in this part of the world. Do y'all grow wheat or corn up here at all? Do you know what the roots of a wheat plant or a corn plant look like? Anybody? Yes? No? This is yes. This is no. Because I need to know if you don't understand this. I got one head nod one way and one head shake the other and the rest of you just staring at me. The roots of a wheat plant or a corn plant, same kind of root system. Instead of having one big tap root like a carrot, or instead of kind of being like an oak tree that have roots that run out along the ground, it has roots that are not real big, kind of on a little ball that shoot out in every direction about this far out from the plant. Hundreds and hundreds of these little tentacles. And if you plant corn close together or wheat close together, what happens is these roots get intertangled. So if you went over and you pulled up a corn plant that's planted real close to another corn plant, the chances are pretty good that when you pulled up one, the other's going to come up with it. That makes sense? Tares are a kind of an invasive weed that represent or imitate wheat. And the point that Jesus makes is, and the reason that God's not going to destroy all the evil when He sets up His kingdom, is because He says, if you pull up the bad stuff, you might pull up some of the good stuff too. What would you think of God if He sent His Son to the world to die on the cross for the sins and then gave no one the opportunity to obey Him? Do you have, any of you have relatives that aren't Christians that you worry about? Do you hope that God gives them time to obey the gospel, to learn the truth? Do you? Sure. What if He didn't? What if they never had the opportunity? What would you think of God? You know what God says in 2 Peter chapter 3 is that He's going to come, but the reality is that He's long-suffering. He doesn't want anyone to perish, but all to come to repentance. And Peter says that's the reason He hasn't come back and destroyed the world yet. He wants people to be saved. Paul makes the same observation in 1 Timothy chapter 2, that God would have all men to come to the knowledge of the truth. And God's very patient and long-suffering with a very wicked world who has rejected Him, in part so that God makes sure people have the opportunity to hear the truth. But what if He never did that? What if He established the kingdom, took the little band of disciples that He had, and destroyed everyone else? Would it change your view of God? Would you see Him as a patient God? As a God who really cares about mankind? As a God who's long-suffering, not willing that people would perish? Or do you see Him the way we very often picture Him, as this mean, angry old man with a thunderbolt just waiting for us to cross the line? As soon as we cross the line, He's going to strike us down. Because I guarantee you, if God did things differently, our view of God would probably be different. People that are good folks might change their mind about God if we didn't see God's mercy along with His severity. And so what Jesus says is, no, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to wait till the end of the world. And then we're going to separate the good from the evil. The apostles needed to know that when they went to preach the kingdom. They needed to know that I'm going to go out there and I'm going to work, and there are going to be some people from the first parable. There are going to be some people that are going to accept the gospel. And they're going to produce. And it's not all going to be gloom and doom. There will be a few. And that's something to take great comfort in. But I also need to understand that wickedness is still going to be all around me, and I'm going to be working in a world where a lot of people don't care about God, and the sons of Satan are going to be there, and they're going to be exercising their influence, and it's not going to be an easy process. People needed to know what they were going to face. Now, if those are the only two parables Jesus offered at this point, I would propose it would be pretty discouraging. A lot of people aren't going to accept what you have to say, guys. And there's still going to be all kinds of evil in the world until the end of the age when God comes in judgment and He'll separate everything out then. Would you want to go preach the gospel under those circumstances? So Jesus says, here's another parable for you. And notice each one of these begin the same way. The kingdom of heaven is like. Here's some things about the kingdom you need to understand. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that a man took, sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all seeds, but when it's grown, it's greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. What's the point of this? Things that start out little and insignificant can become very big. It's that simple. I don't think the branches mean anything. I don't think the birds mean anything. I don't think you ought to pick it to death. What Jesus is trying to say is, look, you're 12 guys from Galilee. You're not educated men. You're not going to set the world on fire because of your talent or who you are or your training or your education or anything else. You're going to start off preaching the gospel in the backwaters of the Roman society, telling people about a guy that hung on a cross and then rose from the dead, and it's going to seem insignificant, but within 30 years people are going to say, those who have turned the world upside down have come here also. They needed to know that it was going to work, that the kingdom was going to grow, and that God's reign would become universal. so that they would be encouraged to go do their work. And he follows up with how that's going to happen. Verse 33, another parable he spoke to them. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal till it was all leavened. We don't talk about leaven much. We use the concept of yeast. Any of you ladies ever baked bread with yeast? You know, put yeast into the dough? I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to answer very carefully. I want you to think about this before you nod your head yes or no. Have you ever seen that yeast permeate that dough? You don't know what to answer, do you? I've got one very vehement. The answer is, you've seen the effects of the yeast permeating the dough. What happens? The dough rises. How is it that that yeast gets from this side of the dough to that side of the dough? You ever wonder that? You don't see it, do you? It doesn't jump out on top and make a mad rush to the other side and take over the lump of dough. It works very silently in ways that you can't see necessarily. It operates on a level that is not visible to the eye. That's what Jesus is trying to get the apostles to understand about the gospel and how it's going to work. They're thinking military. If I'm going to establish a military kingdom, I'm going to have to fight some battles. I'm going to have to make some cavalry charges. I'm going to have to pull my sword and blow the trumpets, and I'm going to have to charge across the field, and I'm going to have to kill some people. But that's not the way the gospel is going to work. It's not going to be big schemes. It's not going to be ornate plans. You're not always going to see it work. It's going to work like leaven works. The influence, whether it's in the heart of a man or whether it's spread from place to place, it's going to be silent. It's going to be in ways that you think, how in the world did that person find out about the gospel? And that's the way it spread. And that's got to be really encouraging to these guys, because they've got to go start throwing the seed out. It's at this point in the context that Jesus dismisses the multitudes. And beginning in verse 44, he tells 3 more parables just to the apostles. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field that a man found and hid, and for the joy of it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. What is the point of this? Well, the point of this is you're going to go teach the gospel, and some people are going to accept it even though they weren't looking for it. Well, what's this man doing in his field, do you reckon? Well, he's working in his field. He's obviously a farmer or a rancher of some kind. He's rented a piece of land, and he's working the piece of land. He's not a treasure hunter. He's not looking for something valuable in the field. He's just working. He's going about his day-to-day affair, and he runs across a treasure that somebody buried in the field. And he recognizes the value of it, and he goes, sells everything that he has and makes every sacrifice he can to buy the field so he can have the treasure. There's going to be times, Jesus wants the apostles to understand, that you're going to be maybe in the city of Corinth working as a tent maker like Paul did. And you're just going to be going about your daily business working, and maybe somebody's going to come in needing you to repair a tent, and you're going to get to talking, and he didn't come there to listen to what you had to say about the gospel of Christ. He's going about his daily business just like you're going about your daily business, and the next thing you know, you're going to teach him about the kingdom, and he's going to recognize how powerful and valuable this is, and he's going to sacrifice everything to have what you're offering. Doesn't that make sense? Not everybody's going to be looking for it, but they'll recognize it when they find it. And the next parable is very much like this. Verse 45, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls. When he found one pearl of great price, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Very much like the last one, right? You see the difference, though. In the former parable, the guy's just out working in his field. He's not looking for treasure. In this parable, this guy's looking for something more valuable than what he has. And the point is, some people are going to come looking for it, guys. You're going to go out charged with teaching the gospel. Sometimes it's going to be so easy you just can't imagine, because there are people out there looking for the truth. And they'll sacrifice other things that they think are valuable for what is more valuable. There was a young man that worshiped with us a few years ago. Showed up one Wednesday night to Bible class. He was a man who had been employed by one of our members, who was part owner of a gym, and this guy had been brought in by a co-worker, because he had experience running gyms. And they had invited, and his name was William, they'd invited William to come to services, and William came to Bible class one Wednesday night. William's about this tall. William's about this broad. And there's not any fat on him. He was an All-American running back at Mississippi State. That's the SEC, folks. That's where they know how to play football. Okay? And by the way, I don't root for an SEC team, so it's hard for me to say that. But nonetheless, he was an All-American running back at Mississippi State. Went on to play professional football, sustained a terrible injury, lost his career. Raised in abject poverty in a two-room shack with multiple numbers of kids. Dad killed in a bar fight, raised by an aunt. Saw terrible poverty, saw great fame, saw great wealth, saw all kinds of... I mean, he experienced life to the fullest. You can imagine what his background was like. And he shows up for Bible class. And he shows up again for Bible class. And he shows up again for Bible class. And I asked him one day, I said, William, you interested in trying to get together to study the Bible? You bet, I sure would be. We had two classes, William obeyed the gospel. To the best of my knowledge, he's still faithful to the Lord. Had to move away a couple years ago. He tried everything life had to offer, but he was still looking for something. And when he found the truth, he sacrificed everything for it. And the apostles needed to know things were going to work that way sometimes. And then Jesus tells them one other parable in verse 47. The kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet that was cast into the sea and gathered some of every kind. When it was full, they drew it to shore. They sat down and gathered the good into vessels and threw the bad away. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth and separate the wicked from among the just. Cast them into the furnace of fire, and there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. This is the one that teaches what we sometimes think the parable of the tare teaches. You know, I don't know this church, but my strong suspicion is that there's someone or ones here that are faking it. We don't know who they are, but God does. And on the day of judgment, God knows who His people are, and God knows who's not really His, and God's going to take care of that. The apostles needed to know that. Because it would have been discouraging for them from time to time to find out that there were ungodly people among God's people. And they needed to be prepared. They needed to know before they went into all the world and taught this kingdom that God had established, they needed to know that not everybody's going to accept it, and they needed to know that some would, and they needed to know that there's still going to be evil in the world, and they needed to know that it's still going to work, even though it starts off small and insignificant. Even though they needed to know it's not always going to be something that you see. The influence is going to spread. And some people aren't going to be looking, and some people are going to be looking, and at the end, God's going to know who are His and who aren't. None of which would have been true of a military temporal kingdom. Now, at this point you're probably thinking, so what? What does this have to do with us? I think this is the way that we are to understand Matthew chapter 13 in its original context. Now, here's the application. Number one, we're still charged with going and teaching the gospel to all the world. I mean, we've sung about it tonight. It's the job of this group of people to do in Kirkland, Washington, in the Seattle, Washington area, the same thing that those people did in Acts chapter 8. When they were scattered abroad because of the persecution in Jerusalem. They went around telling people about the kingdom of heaven. That's our job. And we need to know this stuff. We need to know that some people aren't going to listen and some people will listen and they're not going to last for very long. We had a young woman a couple of years ago who had been very faithful for several years after obeying the gospel. She just up one day and decided she didn't want to be faithful to the Lord anymore. She'd met a young man. She wanted to move in with him and live a life of sexual immorality. And one of the young couples that worships with us that had been very close to her and worked with her and just we really thought she was much more grounded to that. They were just devastated. And I pulled them aside one day and I said, look, read Matthew 13. We need to understand there are going to be people that are going to leave. They're going to obey the gospel. They're going to start bringing fruit. But there are going to be things that are going to cause them to leave. Don't be surprised when people obey the gospel and then quit. Jesus told us it was going to happen. But there will be some that will stick. And don't be surprised when you try your hardest to be a good influence and teach the gospel in this area, that there's still all kinds of ungodliness and wickedness in this world. I mean, Christians act shocked that the United States of America is actually considering homosexuality as a relationship that can be defined by marriage. We're just shocked by that. Why are we shocked by that? We live in a wicked world. God said it's going to be this way. Our job is to try to do what we can to teach the lost. And we need to have some confidence that it works like the mustard seed, even though we may not always see the influence spreading. And there are going to be people that aren't going to be looking for it. So when you're having coffee or when you're on your job, talk to people about the gospel. They may not have come to work that way or come to have a cup of coffee thinking that they're going to hear the truth, but some people are going to recognize it for what it is and sacrifice everything. And some people are going to walk in the back door of the building looking for it. And at the end, God knows who His are and who aren't. So we need to go do our job. That's application number one. Application number two is the point we made this morning about the kingdom. We need a kingdom mentality and help people to understand that we belong to a government that's somewhere else, that's centered in heaven where God reigns. It's a wonderful kingdom. There's no pain, there's no suffering, there's no war, there's eternal life, there's no temptation. And we need to promote it as a kingdom. And then application number three is this, and this one I really like. I suspect it can be useful if you try to talk to people about the gospel. There are a lot of people in this day and age that are very given to premillennial doctrine. I suspect that it's the case with religious people that you know here. It's very much the case really all over the country anymore. And premillennial teaching tries to argue this physical kingdom again, that God's going to come back to the earth and establish a temporal kingdom for 1,000 years. And if you study with someone about this concept, what they're going to do is they're going to want to go to Daniel, and they want to go to Zechariah, and then they're going to go to Matthew chapter 24, and then they're going to go to 1 Thessalonians chapters 4 and 5, and then they're going to try to talk about Revelation a little bit, and they're going to run all over the Bible putting together all these different passages to construct this theory. I want to make a suggestion to you next time you have a study with someone about that issue. Turn to Matthew 13. And have them read these parables about the kingdom, where the kingdom is described. And I want you to notice, none of them fit the scenario of premillennialism. Not one of them. And yet this is Jesus describing the kingdom. None of them fit premillennial doctrine. This stuff was important for these young men to be able to go and do their job because they didn't understand the kingdom. This stuff is important to us to go and do our job, because I'm not sure we properly understand the kingdom. And so I offer that to you because I think it's helpful. It helps me as a preacher, and it helps me as someone that's just trying to get up every day and be a faithful servant of God. And I can't help but think that these guys, as they went off into all the corners of the world, didn't think back to this day from time to time. When they'd been up working all day and just felt like nothing good was happening, or when circumstances exposed some guy in the church that was a Diotrephes that was always causing problems, and how discouraging that could be. And they're thinking, you know, Jesus said this is the way it's going to be. And that's what got them to get up the next day and go do it again. So I want to encourage you. Let's take the good news of the kingdom of heaven as it is portrayed in the Bible, and let's go spread it. We understand now what's going to happen. Well, let's go do our part. Thanks for your attention tonight. If you're subject to the invitation, we invite your response while together we stand and sing.